So a few months ago, well, probably maybe last summer is when Tim finished the series on theology. And part of that series dealt with the Reformation and some of the characters that were part of that movement. And so he touched upon some of the more salient individuals like Calvin and Luther, of course. When we talk about the Reformation, we have to talk about Calvin and Luther. But there were other individuals that he didn't get to talk to or about because, you know, time constraints. If we were to mention everybody who had a hand or who played a part, an important part in the Reformation, then we would be at it for probably years, just talking about that period of about 100, 150 years of church history. And so today I'd like to speak about William Tyndale, which is one of the ones that sort of got left behind, as it were, during that series. And I'm doing so because in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 1, Paul says, "Be imitators of me as I am of Christ." And so when we speak of particular individuals, we do so in order for us to be imitators of them, in order to see what things they did that were good, so we can imitate those things, and what things were not so good, so we can avoid making those mistakes. And that's the idea. Years ago, a very wise person whom I hope will be listening to this message told me that I should read biographies. The biographies of the people of God can be a great source of encouragement and conviction at times as well. And since then, I've sort of set myself the aim and the goal to read several biographies every year. Some are fairly simple, straight to the point. Others are more involved. For example, there's a biography by Tom Nettles of Spurgeon, which is over 600 pages long. And so he goes into a lot of detail. And I remember I read that particular biography when I was in the apartment after our house had sustained the damage from the fire. And by the time that I got done with it, I remember telling Ginger, you know, that I felt like I knew Spurgeon personally. And when I read about his death and his funeral, I almost cried. It was that intense, you know, the way that you got to know the man by the biography that Mr. Nettles, Brother Nettles, wrote. I have just completed a biography of William Tyndale, and so part of what motivated me to speak about Tyndale this morning is that very fact that I just completed that particular biography. That is a short and concise biography of the man who committed himself to translating the Bible into English. And he said, and you probably have heard this many times before, "When I am done," referring to the translation, "the plowman in England will know more about the Bible than the highest bishop." And so that is the man that we consider this morning. So let me give you a little short history of the English Bible, at least up to the point of Tyndale. Today, when we talk about accessing the Bible, it's as difficult as typing a command or saying a command into your phone. Right? There, you go into your phone, and there are probably 50, 60 versions of the Bible in there. A lot of them in English, some of them in other languages. There's some Hebrew ones, Greek, Spanish, and so on and so forth. We've come to take it for granted that there's so many translations and working aids for each Bible student. Some are quite useful, commentaries, dictionaries, encyclopedias. I prefer the printed word myself. And when I mean the printed word, I mean the hard book. When I study, I always go to the book. I don't do it electronically for the most part. Sometimes I do when it deals with languages and things of that nature a lot of times. Programs like Accordance are very useful. But for the most part, I like the hard copy. Be that as it may, you may be the type of person like Steve who likes the electronic version, right? And that's okay. It's the same thing, just a matter of preference. Others are not so useful, right? There are so many translations these days, and a lot of them are pretty much useless. They're translations only in the loose sense of that word. You've probably heard of The Message, for example, the English Bible, and other translations, which are really more paraphrases than anything else. There's a theologian of renown that is fond of saying that there are more translations than there are, there is necessity for them. And they continue to proliferate, not because there's really a necessity for a new, better translation so much as because they have money-making potential. Right? It's just to make more money. Each of the Bibles, pretty much, except for a few, like the King James, obviously, are copyrighted. And because they're copyrighted, only the particular house that published that Bible gets paid for it. And so they keep making new versions so that each house can make more money. And then there's, of course, the fact that translating is as much the art of interpreting as it is translating the words. The Bible translator has to interpret the message that he is seeking to translate as well. It isn't just one word for a Hebrew or a Greek word for an English word, for example. Sometimes you have to get the message, the meaning of the particular passage, in order to translate it into English correctly. And so that is open to abuse. And when I say open to abuse, it's because a lot of folks will insert their theological bias into the translation. And thus, as I mentioned, the message is one glaring example of that particular abuse. For centuries leading to the Middle Ages, the Bible was not only difficult to find, it was restricted to the clergy. Rome, in its efforts to control the people and exert greater dominance over them, forbade the reading of the Bible by the laity. This was not, in the beginning, done as a coordinated or official effort. It was something sort of like it just happened. But eventually it did become the official policy of Rome that, for the people to read the Bible directly was a dangerous thing. And besides, the people were unlearned, so to give them the Bible and to expect them to interpret it correctly was a fool's errand. So the church set up itself as the arbiter of what the Bible was saying and teaching the people accordingly. There was a problem with that, however, and I'll mention that in a little bit when the language is concerned. Often those who sought to either read the Bible or make it accessible to the people were suppressed, and at times they were suppressed at the price of their lives. In the 14th century, we mentioned Wycliffe before. He was a clergy in England who began to question the teachings of the Roman Church when he began to read the Bible. He found a number of things that Rome taught as objectionable. And he was especially repulsed by the way in which the clergy, while teaching the people to not sin, sinned in the most egregious of ways themselves. And so it was a matter of do as I say, not as I do, sort of like the Pharisees of Jesus' time. Eventually, he found a way to produce an English translation of the Bible. However, he did not translate it from the original Greek and Hebrew. He translated it from the Latin Vulgate, and we'll talk more about the Vulgate here in a minute. So a critic of Wycliffe said the following about his translation. He has so translated the scripture that laymen and even women, I know that sounds especially egregious nowadays, right? Who could read were better acquainted therewith than the most literate and intelligent of the clergy. In this way, the gospel pearl is cast abroad and trodden under foot of swine, and that which was before precious, both to clergy and laity, is rendered, as it were, the common jest of both. And so notice the begrudging or the reluctant praise of the translation. In other words, the laymen, women, anybody know more about the word than the clergy itself does. During his lifetime, he was persecuted and hunted, as we have mentioned in times past. However, the Roman Church in the 14th century was going through a lot of problems. And so those problems sort of distracted Rome and the Pope from executing Wycliffe. There were, for example, three popes at one point in the 14th century. At the Council of Constance in the early 15th century, Wycliffe was declared a heretic, and his bones were dug up and burned. After this time, during the 15th century, the early part of the 16th century, no one really came forward with a better English translation. The first printed book by Gutenberg in the middle of the 15th century, was a Bible. However, that Bible was the Latin Vulgate. And so the problem still remained. You know, most of the great majority of people were unable to read that particular version of the Bible. For 1,000 years, that had been the Bible of Rome. It was first translated in the 5th century by Jerome, and it was seen as the official Bible of the church. It was even more important in the view of the Roman church than the Greek and the Hebrew originals were. By the time of the Reformation, however, Latin was in essence a dead language. It was still being used, but it was being used primarily by those who were learned. Official documents and so on and so forth of the church were in Latin, but probably 95% of the populace really didn't know Latin at all unless they had gone to university, which at that time was reserved for pretty much very important people, the cream of the crop, as it were. And so the masses, which were conducted in Latin, were unintelligible to the people who were sitting in the pews. And so the priest was up here, imagine me speaking Latin here. Those of you who know Spanish, Portuguese, French, and so on and so forth would probably get, 70% of the words, but the rest of us would be in the dark. And so imagine preaching the gospel in Latin and 95% of the people don't understand what you're saying. And you're having to trust that the speaker is telling you something that's true. And so that obviously was a big problem. And it got to the point that even some of the priests didn't really know the language very well. And so they were basically saying what they were saying by memory, by rote. They would memorize a particular homily and they would deliver it in Latin without really knowing even themselves what that particular homily was saying. And it was because, the liturgical setting was everybody had to give the same homily everywhere across the empire. I call it the empire, really an empire at this point, but it was referred to as that. So again, Wycliffe had succeeded in translating the Bible in English, but it had not been distributed. Rome had succeeded in suppressing it, and so people were not able yet in the English-speaking world to be able to say, okay, I have access to the Bible. And as I mentioned before, Gutenberg's Bible, even though it had been printed, didn't help because it was in Latin. And so even if you could gotten your hands on one of Gutenberg's Bibles, you still wouldn't understand it anywhere. So for more than a century and a half, until Tyndale's efforts, the English-speaking world really had no Bible to speak of. And that was not just the English-speaking world. It wasn't unique to the English-speaking world, right? Because the Bible being Latin, there really wasn't a German translation, for example, or translations in some of the other vulgar or common languages at the time. But obviously, for our purposes, we're concentrating on the English Bible. Enter Erasmus, and you probably heard me speak about Erasmus before, who was a Dutch humanist of the early 15th century. And what he sought to do was to print a diglot, a New Testament diglot, in both Greek and Latin, and to publish it, because he thought that it was important for the original language of the New Testament to be recovered. So his successful efforts, what did they do? They formed the basis for Luther's Reformation, indirectly, because Erasmus, even though he thought that the church needed to be reformed, but he thought that Luther had gone too far too fast. He thought that the church, although badly in need of reformation, should have been reformed at a slower pace. And some of the things that the church taught, for example, transubstantiation, were seen by Erasmus as something that didn't need to be changed. And so there were a number of things like that that Erasmus saw were not in need of reformation that Luther obviously did. And so eventually, Erasmus and Luther sort of parted ways very strongly. Luther created a Bible in German. After he was kidnapped following the Diet of Worms, he spent a year at Orberg Castle conducting the effort to translate the Bible into the German language. And so for a year he did this work, and you can imagine one individual doing that work That entire word from Hebrew, from Greek, and his German translation is a good, a very good translation even to this day. So amazing work for one individual. And it's amazing what a person can do when God is helping the effort, right? So Tyndale sought to follow the German reformer by translating the Bible into the language of his people. It is important to point out that Tyndale was very knowledgeable in languages, of the languages of his time. He knew fairly well several languages and was fluent in a number of others. His education, which had begun in Oxford in England when he was a young teenager, had served him well in the mission that he was going to undertake for God. And we'll see this later towards the end of the message when we talk about the providence of God. He was able not only to consult the Greek, the original of the New Testament, but he also was able to consult Luther's German New Testament, the Latin, the Vulgate, as well as the original Hebrew text for the Old Testament and the Wycliffe Bible as well, which by this time was becoming a little more accessible to some of the clergy. And thus, he produced a New Testament that was as complete as any could have been up to that point. In fact, about 90 years later, the King James translators used Tyndale's New Testament as the launching pad, so to speak, for their own version, their own translation, which was published in 1611. And so even though nearly 100 years have passed since Tyndale had produced his own version, by the time that the King James translators came along, they still made use of Tyndale's version. And a lot of the terminology that the King James uses is preserving the terminology that Tyndale used. And I'll mention a little more of this later in the message. The important thing about knowing languages, being a polyglot, as it were, sort of like Freddie is. I don't know where he is. There he is. So, as Freddie is, you know, the idea of knowing a multiplicity of languages and knowing them well, is that languages, other than English, many languages are much more complete in their construction than English is. And what I mean by that is, for example, tenses, genders are much more prevalent in other languages than they are in English. For example, everything in Spanish pretty much has a gender. It's either male or female. Numbers, when you talk about pronouns, numbers are much more prevalent in Spanish. You know, if you say you in English, for example, you can be referring to a group or you can be referring to a person. Whereas in Spanish, you may use usted and ustedes, and there you have, with the word itself, you don't need even the context to know that you're referring either to a singular or a plural. And Greek is the same way. Hebrew is the same way. The original languages of the Bible are the same way. In Greek, for example, word endings tell you whether it's a male, whether it's a female, whether it's a plural, whether it's a singular, past, present, etc. And so you have the fact that those languages are much more complete than English. And if you know those languages, you're translating those languages into English, you're able to convey that meaning and that message better than if you just know them superficially. Tyndale is the father of many of a number of terms that eventually became common in the English language. And that's what I mentioned when a lot of the terms that he invented, he's believed to have invented, came into directly into the King James Version. For example, network, Thanksgiving, Passover, circumcise, birthright, and whoremonger are just some of the words that he invented. That before, for example, they had to use two words to express the meaning of that particular Greek or Hebrew word. Paul did the same thing in Greek when he wrote the New Testament. There's some words that he formed a compound of two words for one word, and so they came down in the language as being that particular word, meaning that particular idea, but they did not exist before he coined them in the New Testament. And so in that way, Tyndale was very similar to Paul. Obviously, Tyndale was persecuted. He was harassed for his work. You would think that someone who wanted to give the Bible to the people, in other words, who wanted to make it possible for the people to learn what salvation is all about would be treated as a hero. But on the contrary, he was branded a heretic. Anyone who tried to do anything similar to that was branded a heretic. He was no exception. He had to move from England to Germany. He came in and out of Germany a number of times. He lived in Belgium. He lived in England as well for a number of years. And he had a collaborator. His name was William Roy. And unfortunately, William Roy had a bit of a loose tongue. And so one time he was at a bar talking about the work that he and Tyndale were undertaking. They were in Germany at the time. And so unfortunately some folks discovered the work that Tyndale was doing, and Tyndale had to move. There was an individual also called John Dobnek, who was better known to history as John Cocleus, who overheard the printers that were working on Tyndale's New Testament talking about the work that they were doing. And it's interesting because the printers that were doing the work for Tyndale were staunch, faithful Catholics. But they still did the work for Tyndale. And they still did it secretly. Now, you could say, well, they wanted to make the money or whatever. Perhaps. Maybe it was purely mercenary. But nevertheless, they tried to do this as quietly and as privately as they could. Unfortunately, the work was eventually discovered, and the printer himself got into much trouble with the authorities. So what happens? Tyndale has to leave. Germany eventually ends up in Belgium, and we'll pick up his particular residency here in a little bit. But he continued his work, nevertheless. And you can imagine, he's basically running out that one door while the authorities are entering through another. And that happens a number of times, not just once, but again. But he had perseverance, and that perseverance paid off. Even in the midst of all these dangers, he persevered. By 1526, his and Roy's work on the New Testament had been completed. Within a year of 1526, 6,000 copies of the New Testament had been printed and had been sold. Now, you may think, nowadays, 6,000 copies, that's nothing, right? I mean, that could be sold in a day in a library here in the States. But in that era, in that time, when the Bible was suppressed the way it was, that was a huge number. And so you can see the success that that endeavor had. And the Bibles had to be smuggled into England. They had to be put in like sacks of grain and things of that nature in order to be carried to England. They weren't just put in boxes and shipped openly to England. And so again, that was another complication that made the fact that so many were sold rather remarkable. Eventually, Tyndale and Roy part ways, not acrimoniously, but simply because Tyndale realized that Roy was a little bit loose-tongued, and so if he was going to continue his work, he wanted to continue the work on the Old Testament, that he was going to have to do it with somebody who was not so prone to let people know what was going on. Thomas Wolsey, who was Henry's bishop, continued to try to destroy Tyndale. And it's important for us to realize that Henry, although Henry VIII, is famous for his supposed break with the church and establishing the Church of England and so on and so forth, but Henry was really a staunch Catholic. He was not an individual who liked what Luther was doing necessarily. And so he was wanting Tyndale to be apprehended as well, to be brought to him, as he often would put it. So Wolsey, speaking of Tyndale's and Roy's work, said the following. The translation was intermingled with certain articles of heretical depravity and pernicious erroneous opinions, pestilent, scandalous, and seductive of simple minds, of which translation many books containing the pestilent and pernicious poison in the vulgar, that is the common tongue, have been dispersed in great numbers throughout our diocese, which truly, unless they be speedily foreseen, will without doubt infect and contaminate the flock committed to us with the pestilent poison and the deadly disease of heretical depravity. You can no doubt notice the 16th century language there, language that was a lot more colorful than it is today when used by people in those positions. But what happens? The providence of God intervenes. And so Henry VIII has a problem with Catherine, whom he had married. Catherine hasn't given him a male heir. And so what does he do? He seeks to divorce his wife. The Pope will have none of it. And so for a while, there's a tussle, you know, a standoff between Henry and the Pope over whether the Pope is going to annul, accept the annulment of Henry's and Catherine's marriage. A priest named Campeggio, who was Rome's legate to address the issue with Henry, was under orders to obfuscate, to delay, to try various tactics to try to delay confrontation between Henry and between the Pope. At this time also, the Pope is taken captive by Charles V. Charles V and the Pope had a falling out with one another. And so Charles decided, you know, I'm going to basically put the Pope in jail. He wasn't in jail, but he was basically on the house arrest, so to speak. And so the Pope was very restricted in what he could do. And so because of that, the issues surrounding his battle with the Pope distracted Henry and kept him sort of like from earnestly pursuing Tyndale. On top of that, when Henry eventually succeeds in divorcing Catherine and then marrying Anne Boleyn, what happens? Anne is a sympathizer of the reformers. And so that also has a tempering effect on Henry as well. Eventually, however, the persecution picks up again, you know, becomes strong again. Thomas Hinton, who was a friend of Tyndale, is burned at the stake in 1530 for admitting, among other things, that he has purchased an English New Testament. He's called to recant. He does not, and he is burned at the stake. There are many others who are in prison. They're harassed. Wolsey continues to persecute anyone who dares to contradict him. During this time, Tyndale not only is translating the Bible, he is continuing to refine the New Testament, but also working on the Old Testament. But he also writes three important books: The Parable of the Wicked Mammon, The Obedience of the Christian Man, and The Practice of Prelates, Whether the King's Grace May Be Separated from His Queen, because she was his brother's wife. And it was this last book which attacked the king, and more so Wolsey himself, that was the biggest bone of contention. One biographer said that Tyndale's readers would have glanced at the title and immediately understood that The Practice of Prelates was an indictment of the underhanded scheming of church leaders. Wolsey eventually falls out of favor with the king. The king summons him to London to be tried, but he dies of dysentery on his way there, and he is replaced by Thomas More, who takes his place. Thomas More was a very learned individual, took Wolsey's place, but continued that persecution. And in the case of More, you know, we don't know about Wolsey, but in the case of More, he saw himself as a faithful son of the church who needed to suppress this movement because the church was being attacked. You know, God himself was being attacked. And so you could say he did it with good motives. You know, his actions were still evil and wrong, but his motivation was, if you want to say good, you know, you could say good, even though that's obviously questionable. But, you know, the persecution continues, more are executed, and Tyndale continued to refine the Bible. In 1532, another version, a second version, comes out that is refined and better than the version of 1526. However, you know, eventually the end came. An individual by the name of Henry Phillips had been expelled from Germany, from the lands where the Reformation was taking hold. And there's a thing about the Reformation, and you probably remember Tim talking about the fact that the Reformation was a magisterial Reformation. And what we mean by magisterial Reformation is that the Protestant church has not just become what it is today, where you come into San Antonio and there's a Baptist church and there's a Presbyterian church and there's a Methodist church and this church and that church and the other church. And everybody's there and they're just doing their thing. Nobody is looking over the shoulder of the other congregation to see what they're doing. and to, you know, say, okay, you're doing something wrong, we're going to attack you personally. In the case of the first centuries, probably, we could say, of the Reformation, it was like that. It was the fact that there was a state church, basically. And so if Rome was no longer the state church in Frankfurt, for example, now the Lutheran church was the state church. You know, and that Lutheran church still sought to suppress now the Roman church, but also any others, like, let's say, the Anabaptists, for example, who were not submitting themselves to the authority of that particular Lutheran church. And so that's what happened to Henry Phillips. Henry Phillips, because he was a Catholic, a firm Catholic, a faithful Catholic, he was expelled from Frankfurt because of that faithfulness to the Roman church. Because of that, among other things, he was very ill-disposed to the reformers. You know, he was very inimical to the Reformation and to the reformers themselves. He was a strong Catholic, as I mentioned, and what does he do? He befriends Tyndale and offers himself to the Catholic authorities to surveil Tyndale and eventually to betray him. Eventually, Tyndale makes his way to Belgium, to Antwerp, a city there in Belgium, and he is arrested, kept under imprisonment. He is extradited loosely. I use that word because it's not the extradition that we recognize in the 21st century, where there's a legal process and you talk to the authorities in the other country and you have to go through all of this extradition request and so on and so forth. At the time, basically, if you had enough power in that particular city, you would just go and surreptitiously kidnap somebody, basically, and bring them back to your country to be judged or tried there. So eventually he is captured in Antwerp and brought back to England. For months he is kept in a dungeon. However, he continued to work on translating the Old Testament. His Hebrew translation continued during these months in captivity. He was offered release. The only thing he had to do was to recant and basically to say that what he had done was wrong, that the Roman church was absolutely right, and so on and so forth. As we can surmise by now, he refused to do so. And so on October 6, 1536, he is taken to be executed. He was strangled first, and so he was strangled and he died. That was the cause of death, but then his body was burned. As he was getting ready to be executed, he said, Lord, open the eyes of the King of England. The prayer is answered, and is answered rather quickly, because Henry, shortly thereafter, approved the circulation of the English Bible in England. And he does that because his controversy, his feud with the Pope had reached a head, and so now Henry declares himself the head of the church, the head of the Church of England. He breaks with the Pope, and so what happens? Now the Bible is freely distributed throughout England. Unfortunately, it didn't come quickly enough for Tyndale to be spared. A commentator said about the translation that Tyndale produced: the peculiar genius which breathes through it, the mingled tenderness and majesty, the Saxon simplicity, the preternatural grandeur, unequal, unapproached, and the attempted improvements of modern scholars all bear the impress of the mind of one man, William Tyndale. Lying while engaged in that great office under the shadow of death, the sword above his head and ready at any moment to fall, he worked under circumstances alone perhaps truly worthy of the task which was laid upon him. His spirit, as it were, divorced from the world, moved in a purer element than common air. So in conclusion, I mentioned at the outset of the message that we study the believers, the outstanding believers of years and centuries past in order to learn from them. So what can we learn from Tyndale? A number of things. Number one, commitment. Tyndale understood that his efforts may lead to the stake. Upon hearing that his New Testaments were often relegated to the flames, he said that even he may be relegated to the flames someday. And so he had no illusions that what he was doing was something that was safe physically, or that it would not, it was not dangerous for him personally. In fact, he was willing at one point to go back to England and be executed, so long as the king guaranteed that he would allow the New Testament in English to be distributed to the people. And how many of us can say something like that, that we can face sure death as long as the word continues to be preached? In spite of the dangers, he pressed on. And we have a debt of gratitude to him for that. Secondly, it is important for us to learn from Tyndale that we should not discount the work that God can do if God has called us to it. Not everyone is called to being a pastor or being a missionary in a foreign land, obviously. But everyone is called to some work in the kingdom. God does not save us to be lazy believers and to sit in the pew, right, to be spectators. One commentator talked about how often in the church we go out and we invite people to come to services, and they perhaps become believers, and then we make them spectators just like us, right? We just basically sit there and listen to the preacher preach, and to the elders do the work, and to the deacons do the work of maintaining and sustaining the congregation, and then the rest of the congregation just kind of sits there and enjoys the fruit of those labors. That's not what we're saved for, right? We are saved in order to be workers. We can help those who are in need, whether within or outside the body. We can preach in our community if we have that gift of preaching, and we can go door knocking. We can do a number of things. We'll talk a little more about that particular issue of the evangelizing in the second service coming up. Number three, we learned perseverance from Tyndale. Paul said that perseverance brings about hope in Romans chapter 8. Tyndale persevered in his efforts, even though they seemed at one time impossible. How can one man overcome the hostility of an institution like the Roman Catholic Church? Tyndale knew that for centuries before him, all of those who dared to stand up to the Church of Rome died very often for their daring. And yet he did it anyway, because he persevered, because he was convinced his mission was from God. Hebrews 11:27 talks about Moses, who persevered as one seeing that which is unseen. And so in the same way, we can speak of Tyndale, that he saw that New Testament in English. He saw the people being able to read it, learning, understanding, and becoming followers of Christ. And because he had that vision, he persevered in his work. His philosophy, no doubt, was if God is for us, who can be against us? We also learn a lot about the providence of God. We look back now and we see how God orchestrated the events in the life of Tyndale, as indeed he is orchestrating all of our lives. You know, we don't see it now, but in retrospect, we look back and we say all of those things that happened in our lives have made us into who we are today and have led to who we are today and what we're doing for the Lord today. Take, for example, the fact that the printing press was invented in the middle of the 15th century. There was greater mobility in 16th century Europe than there ever been before. The Tyndale's facility with languages, there was increasing openness to the ideas of the reformers. You know, it's sort of like the coming of Christ, right? Why did Christ come when he came? Because it was the right time. It was the fullness of time. And so why did the Reformation happen when it happened? Because it was the right time for it to take place. There was in the mind of people that hunger for something more than they have been fed by the Roman Church. And so that also made it possible for him to do his work. there's also the fact that, a curious thing, those who were opposing Tyndale's New Testament in England, how did they go about trying to eliminate it? They bought all the copies they could in order to burn them. And so the problem was that the money, of course, went to the people who were printing the New Testament. And so more New Testaments kept being printed with the money from the people who were buying them in order to burn them. And so more got into circulation because of that. And so the enemies of the work themselves were helping, unbeknownst to them and unwillingly, certainly, to do it. Or to expand the distribution of the New Testament. It's as Gamaliel said in Acts chapter 5, if this be of God, you cannot overcome it. And indeed, they could not overcome it. And then, finally, we also learn that sometimes the greatest enemies of the faith are those who purport to be friends of Christ. Take Cardinal Wolsey, for example, Thomas More, who were Tyndale's implacable enemies. Many church prelates sought to discredit and kill him. His great sin was wanting the Bible in the language of the people. Bear in mind, these were the people who were professing to be Christ's representatives, and yet they were seeking to destroy an individual who was trying to bring Christ's word to the people. Those who are supposed to teach biblical truth sometimes become the greatest enemies of truth. Jesus said in John 16:2, the time will come when those who kill you will think they are doing God a favor. And in Matthew 10:36, he spoke about a man's enemies being those of his own household. And so it is important for us to recognize that reality, because in our own day, we see many in government who are supposed people of faith, but they're working tirelessly to destroy the faith that they purport to hold. And they try to put forth and to support policies and ideas that will bring about, if it were possible, the end of the church. And so it's important for us to recognize that reality and to resist those efforts in whatever form they come. And so Tyndale stands as a testament, pardon the pun, right? A testament to what God can do when we submit ourselves to Him.